Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, a new report finds sea level rise threatens billions of dollars worth of Bay Area development, from new homes to sports stadiums. Yet local governments are doing little to address this, potentially leaving taxpayers on the hook for costly repairs. We talk to the report's authors. Then at 9:30, California law says cyclists must come to complete stops at stop signs, just as cars are required to. But some San Francisco bicycle activists say the law is wrong-headed. Could it be safer for cyclists to roll through stop signs? We'll take up that debate. Join us on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Bay Area has been in the midst of a huge building boom. Sports stadiums, housing developments, they're all in the pipeline. But reporters with the San Francisco Public Press find dozens of these projects are on land that could be flooded by century's end. Nearly 30 major developments are vulnerable to sea level rise from climate change, they say. Yet little is being done to deal with this. And that means taxpayers could be on the hook for expensive fixes later. Joining me is San Francisco Public Press reporter Kevin Stark. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
And Michael Stoll. He's editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Public Press. Good morning, Michael Stoll, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So, Kevin Stark, this was a very comprehensive report that you put out this week. Talk a little bit about sort of the genesis of this.
Well, it was Michael's idea in the beginning, and we had seen a lot of sea level rise reports that were static or retrospective, kind of looking at how sea level rise was impacting the Bay as it exists now, and we wanted to do a forward-looking piece that was taking into account where we were building now. So looking at developments that were going to be in an area that would be impacted by sea level rise that were happening right now.
So what are the developments around the Bay Area that you're most concerned about?
So we found 27 major projects around the Bay that range from the new Warrior Stadium to Treasure Island, some other projects in San Francisco. In the South Bay, the headquarters of Facebook and LinkedIn and some other technology companies.
Yeah, it sounds like technology companies are doing a lot, like Google, Microsoft, LinkedIn, and Facebook, to really drive this bayfront development explosion, Michael Stoll?
There's so much pressure to build. The Bay Area economy is really booming, and there's a limited time that policymakers have to deal with how to regulate the shoreline as the climate change debate is really heating up, and there's an increasing amount of science saying that sea level rise is going to be a real problem, and all of the science says that there's going to be several feet of sea level rise by the year 2100. We just don't know exactly how much. And a lot of this planning is being done in this climate of uncertainty. The question is how much precaution to take.
And you mentioned that there are a lot of pressures that are driving, you know, approving these kinds of developments. Can you talk a little bit about what those are specifically? I mean, one I imagine is that cities stand to make money.
Well, cities stand to make hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue. And some are even creating development zones that are right up to the water's edge, and in fact, in areas that used to be salt marshes, especially down in the South Bay. And this is something that local governments are really inconsistent about regulating. So some predict that sea level will only rise a foot and a half by a certain year before 2100. Others take the long view that it may rise 4.5 feet, but most don't even take into account the extra danger of storm surges. A 100-year storm could add more than 3 feet of additional sea level rise on a temporary basis, temporarily flooding some of these properties. And so it's a really complicated problem how to deal with this in existing properties, let alone new properties that are being built right now.
Now, Kevin Stark, you used 8 feet, correct, as a cutoff point for what scientists think would be a maximum sea level rise plus major storm swell, as Michael Stoll is mentioning.
Yeah.
Yes. So, but a lot of the studies, the scientists sort of expect 3 feet of rise by 2100. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, is 8 feet, it is on the high end.
It is on the high end. It's a bad day at the end of the century. And with the climate change projections, they do fall in ranges, especially as you get to projections that are later in the century. So 3 feet is kind of the consensus understanding of how much we'll experience in terms of actual sea level rise. But there's so many other factors that go into it. You can talk about king tides and storm surges. The number that we chose for storm surge that calculates up to 8 feet is the figures that are used by the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, by the regulators. It's what they plan for in terms of a bad day.
We're talking with reporter Kevin Stark and editor-in-chief Michael Stoll, both with the San Francisco Public Press, about the risks posed by sea level rise on dozens of Bay Area waterfront development projects. This is a half-hour segment, so if you want to join with your questions or comments, give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, post your comments on our Facebook page or on our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can also tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Now, developers say they have taken sea level rise into account, that they have the engineering, they have the financial wherewithal to address, you know, future flooding risk.
Oh, and I don't want to discount that, because I think they're doing a lot of work and really taking things into account. They're setting buildings back, they're raising them up, and they're also putting in some type of levee or structure that will protect it in the event of a storm. The problem with that is that it's sort of a canvas approach around the bay, or a quilt approach around the bay. If you know, one area is protected, let's say we built a seawall around San Francisco, that could essentially just move the water into another city. So what we really need is some type of regional solution, regional collaboration, where we're taking sea level rise into account in all locations.
Mike Stoll.
Taking sea level rise into account can mean a lot of things. And so far, the environmental permitting process really relies on developers to offer their own predictions. They all have to be based on science, but they take advantage of the uncertainty in the science to pick and choose predictions for sea level rise that best match their development plans. And most of the local governments, the cities and counties that are approving these things, that are setting zoning policies, that are even some of them offering incentives to build in some of these vulnerable areas, they rely on the developers to offer a reasonable scenario. And the problem is that it creates this really inconsistent way of managing the shoreline. So some areas may be flooded within a couple of decades.
You know, it's also real estate developers work with a much shorter timeline, I imagine. I mean, you're doing a study about flooding that could occur by mid-century or century's end. Is that a big challenge also in terms of trying to get both developers to look at something that far out, but also even the public to put the pressure that might be needed to address this?
Absolutely. There's a wide range of time horizons that planners and local officials and developers have in mind. One developer, when we asked for comment on their development plans, said, well, we can't talk to you right now. We have a policy of radio silence until our next quarterly earnings report. That's kind of an extreme example, but we're asking questions about long-term thinking. Some of the scientists who really look into this deeply and who have, you know, created these computer models that create predictions for sea level rise, and there is a significant range, but they all say, do you want to plan for something that is the most likely to happen, or do you want to plan for something that could happen within a human lifetime? You know, there will be people who are born today who are alive and will be taxpayers in the year 2100. It's hard for us to think of that right now. But what kind of burden are we giving them? There's a lot of talk about multi-billion dollar projects to protect, say, the Embarcadero, a 10-mile wall wrapping around all the finger piers on the eastern side of the city that could cost $2.7 billion. That was the last report from the Port of San Francisco. And that's just a very preliminary study. You multiply that by all of the cities all around the bay, and you're talking about many tens of billions of dollars. And the price would only increase if there were that much more development.
And let's go to some of your calls. Let's go to John in Menlo Park. Hi, John.
Hello. Thank you very much for this discussion. This is a really critical topic. Last week in the Journal of Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics, James Hansen released a paper suggesting that the centerline value that we ought to be using for 2050 is more like 10 feet of baseline sea level rise, that there are a lot of metrics that have not really been previously considered. Greenland melting alone is 22 feet. The West Antarctic ice sheet is a similar amount. And the paleoclimate data suggests that the models that we're using haven't really considered how fast some of the ice could melt. What about these alternate scenarios, and how do we build them into planning? And because the data, that is, this is an area of how fast during our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes, what is the number that we're planning for, seems like a critical topic.
Michael Stoll, are you familiar with the study that John's talking about? And
yeah, it just came out a couple of days before we went to press, so we couldn't include the ramifications of that in our print edition. But the trend in the science community is year after year, new studies come out, and mostly they go upward. And that's largely because of the uncertainty in the melt rate in Antarctica. And it's as hard as it is to predict 85 years from now how much thermal expansion in the sea there is and how much glaciers are going to melt on land, it's very squirrely to try to predict the flow of these mile-thick ice caps in Antarctica and Greenland. And as the science improves on the melting of ice, most of the predictions go up. And really the question is there an upper limit that we should be paying attention to, especially for critical infrastructure like hospitals, emergency services centers, residential areas? And, you know, we found a couple of examples of critical infrastructure below the 8-foot line where we were looking at. You know, when we picked 8 feet, we were accused by some of our sources of catastrophication, that we were focusing on the worst case example. Well, already, you know, a week after we published, there are credible scientists saying it could be much higher, much faster.
And to John's question, how are, you know, planning entities for various cities trying to address the threat? I mean, what are they really using, and how are they doing that? Kevin Stark.
Yeah, thank you for the question, because I think it really gets to the heart of how complex this issue is for planners. And in the city of San Francisco, there's been a study where the city really did a deep dive into the science to try and figure out what is the number to plan for. And 3 feet is kind of the consensus figure that people have taken from that study. But you see with this new study that just came out that it's really complicated, and that generally these projections are going to change. So in terms of policy, you have to have something that's adaptive, that can change with the science, and that can also change for the topography and geography of the land.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to John in Canyon. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. What's your question?
I was just curious, considering the average height of a lot of the cities in the Bay Area, wouldn't it be a whole lot cheaper to put a sort of lock system at the Golden Gate Bridge entrance? I mean, I know it'd be unsightly, but that might be the best way to protect the Bay Area.
Kevin Stark, what about a lock system?
You know, this has come up. This comes up in a lot of interviews, and it's a little bit beyond my scope. But I want to say that politically, it would be extremely difficult. And I also think, just in terms of engineering, it would also be extremely difficult because you're talking about a two-way street. Water needs to come in and come out, plus all the shipping that comes in through the Golden Gate. So, you know, it's really complicated. It would be unsightly and also politically very difficult.
Okay, then what geoengineering solutions could work?
Well, I mean, there's always levees, except for levees are only 100% effective until they're 100% ineffective. There's a lot of adaptive strategies where you can actually live with water coming in.
Wetlands, for example, wetland restoration.
Wetlands are having some type of system where a canal system where if there's a storm, water can come in and it's sort of like a snow day on the East Coast. People leave and then come back the next day and it's business as usual.
Michael Stoll, wetlands restoration projects are underway. Aren't they enough?
They're enough for now. Wetlands mostly protect against bad storms. And if you add sea level rise on top of that, you're going to inundate most of the wetlands that are being built up right now and being restored. And it's really a race. Some wetlands are designed to grow vertically and you can add to them. But like a lot of the beaches around the world, there's only so high you can build them before the water comes right up to the built-up shoreline.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, how are you? You know, I've been hearing about this for a lot of years, and it's not just San Francisco. It's the entire world. And if I remember right, about 90% of the world's population lives near the ocean. So if global warming causes this rise, it's not just here. It's 90% of the public is going to be hit by this. But I wanted to ask, in terms of many cities offer tax incentive bond issues for corporations to move into them. So if these new buildings, and I would bet that there are a bunch of corporate headquarters that are stashed in these various sites that you're talking about, are they getting like a 30-year tax incentive to come here, but the flooding is going to get here in 24 years?
Kevin Stark, you did look at how cities are offering developers tax credits and other incentives.
Yeah, I want to just go back to the first point that you made about this is an issue for the whole world, which is interesting. And I want to say a couple things about San Francisco. In some ways, we are insulated. We don't have hurricanes. We have the peninsula, which is protecting most of the bay from the regular wave system that would be happening with oceans. So, you know, in some ways, we are more protected than in other places in the world. And we also have a very engaged public and an activated group of policymakers. So I think those are all pluses. But that doesn't mean that we can't act, and that doesn't mean that we are not going to be impacted.
Did you want to address his point about the type of incentives that developers are receiving?
Yeah, well, I do want to say that there is just this culture of encouragement of development. There's a lot of money that's happening in the Bay, and in some ways we need developers to help pay for the solutions. So there's this interesting triangle relationship where development is needed to get insurance money and loan money to pay for the adaptation strategies. But then the flip side to that coin is then now you have housing developments that are happening in areas that could be impacted by flooding. And then the question is who pays for the needed adaptations down the line.
A listener writes, a bunch of houses flooding is unfortunate. The flooding of a bunch of legacy landfills and hazardous waste sites is where the greater risk is. Another listener writes, I wonder if floating home settlements on the bay built to be affordable for non-tech people might be just the thing to ease the housing crisis while also being climate change proof. We didn't talk about this too much, but, you know, of course, the need for housing is also what's driving a lot of the development right now.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, the conversation around a lot of these developments. I mean, there are some huge developments being built. Hunter's Point, I think it's 12,000 homes that are eventually going to be built. About 2,000 at Pier 70, a couple of hundred at Mission Rock, which is right across the water from AT&T Park. There's a lot of housing going in. And most of the conversation so far has been really on the affordable housing question, and local officials at the Board of Supervisors are really grilling these developers and trying to extract more concessions on raising the number of affordable units. And so there are a bunch of really serious competing concerns. The affordable housing question is the issue of the day. But sea level rise is there. It's kind of bubbling up in the background. And eventually we're going to have to deal with that as well.
Phil writes, no one could have forecasted the changes of the last 100 years. Anyone who assumes they can predict a sea level change in 100 years from now is lying. The science of fear-mongering feeds on stories of global warming. Everything in the story you're discussing is tied to a could-be. You're shaking your head, Kevin Stark.
Well, I just think it's an interesting point. Sea level rise in some way is divorced from the politics of climate change because we do have science that shows that it has already risen. And we do have very sophisticated science that shows that it is going to continue to rise at an accelerated rate. So I guess I take issue with the phrasing. I really think that the science is getting more refined, more sophisticated. Scientists are at the point now where they're making subtle adjustments, and it really is becoming much more accurate.
So, Kevin Stark, what do you propose should occur? A moratorium on private developments?
We're certainly not suggesting that. We're suggesting that there needs to be specific regulation that targets private development that currently does not exist. And we're also suggesting that there needs to really be a public conversation about sea level rise and development because that's not happening.
But moratoriums have been suggested by some.
Certainly, but that's not what we're suggesting with our report.
Yeah, and Michael Stoll, I wonder, are there cities or regions that you feel are doing this well, or also, Kevin Stark, things that you've come up in your reporting as areas that are doing this well?
Well, I think the lesson, there have been a number of major flooding events in the last 10 years. There was Hurricane Katrina, where you saw the vulnerability of a levee. You saw Hurricane Sandy, 14-foot swells in Brooklyn and lower Manhattan. And both of those cities have definitely recovered, but are also making much longer term plans based on the certainty that such events will happen again, and they need to be prepared. So they're putting in billions of dollars in additional flood walls. New York City wants to raise all the critical infrastructure, a story to anticipate future floods.
Kevin Stark, quickly, models in the Bay Area.
There's a lot of things that are – a lot of interesting ideas that are being proposed. SPUR is working on a report right now about Mission Bay and different strategies that can happen there. I think we need to be creative. We need to think beyond just seawalls. We need to think how we can live with water coming in. And in that way, we can be really creative and create really interesting new positive benefits for the community.
Well, thank you to both of you, Kevin Stark and Michael Stoll, for your reporting on this. A link to the article is on our website. We were joined by San Francisco Public Press reporters Kevin Stark and Michael Stoll. Up next, we take up the question of whether cyclists should come to a full stop at stop signs. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Stay with us.